screen was hanging straight behind the repeater. And I told them, and they looked at me with cross eyes when I told them that this hanging this way, that you got to fasten it to the back of the repeater. Otherwise, actually, distortion of the magnetic field within the circulator is going to create this particular problem that you're having. And and actually, was screwing up the system. That's very important, how you handle a circulator, basically, Dick, over.
Comment, I want to make a very important comment here.
Howie recognized, when you're adjusting a circulator for really high performance, 30, 35 or so dB of directivity, there's an extremely precise magnitude of magnetic field required to do that. A well-manufactured circulator will have a sign on it saying, do not bring any magnetic materials within X number of inches of this particular device for fear that you may degauss it. You may make a magnetic measurement with your Gauss meter before and after you've exposed it to your particular magnetic wrench that you've made the mistake of letting get sucked into your particular circulator that happened to be not very well magnetically shielded. And you may think you've done nothing. You could have very easily detuned the thing by slightly degaussing that carefully tuned magnetic field in there. And so your 35 dB of isolation may have just jumped down to 25 dB. So when you do get a good circulator, good for your particular power level, good for your degree of directivity, treat it with tender loving care. Mount it correctly. Don't let it get bounced. Mount it near non-magnetic materials. Don't allow magnetic materials to come near it. Don't overheat it. Don't overpower. Don't put too much power into it so it becomes overheated. And so on. When you finally get one that works well, treat it properly. Go ahead, Howie. KQRIW in the TechNet.
You're supposed to properly mount them onto the metal plate. But number two, one good reason to use a circulator, it can save you a lot of grief. Because if you get a bad antenna and you get high SWR, the circulator and your dummy load will take the punishment, not the amplifier. So some people don't go out and buy a circulator for the repeater, but in the long run, it can save you a lot of grief because it can protect that $1,000 amplifier, you know, that nice 200-watt amp. That's why you should use the circulator, Dick. I think you know that it protects you from, you know, shorted cables, from an antenna breaking, whatever.
There are a significant number of cases where a circulator added to a transmitter can stop a desensitization problem. By desensitization, I mean you turn off the transmitter of your single-site repeater, one-antenna-type repeater, and you carefully measure receiver sensitivity at the antenna port by way of some kind of a blitz-bug-type coupler at the antenna port. You measure the sensitivity, and you find it's 0.15 microvolts, which is a pretty good one. Then you turn on the transmitter, and you find out your brand-new sensitivity is some much worse number. The desensitization, there's a zillion ways it could be happening, but it could be happening because of undesired signals being coupled back into your transmitter and putting a circulator on your transmitter. In some cases, can improve the desensitization situation as well as making your transmitter a hell of a lot more friendly for all the other two-way transmitters that are located at your particular high-altitude site on this beautiful building, if you know what I mean. So unless you're the only guy on the top of that building, every single transmitter up there better have a circulator, a good high-performance circulator, on its individual transmitters. Or you're going to create grief for somebody. It's only a matter of when, how much grief, and how much they hammer on you when they find out you've done it, you violated the contract by which you got there in the first place. And as Howie said earlier, there's a certain probability you're going to be kicked off the site, declared persona non grata, and told never come back, don't call us, we'll call you. We can't tolerate the grief that you create. You're affecting cash flow of a whole lot of customers simultaneously. You're costing us so much money, we can't tolerate you. You don't want that to happen. Understand the situation and treat the circulator correctly. Anybody have any further comments? Take your
repeater, timeout, cancel.
Okay, just want to let me make another comment here, because you just brought something up very interesting.
Okay, go ahead, Eric. I know we've been timing it out. Sorry about that.
No, that's no problem. I just wanted to let you know that the offending signals you were hearing before were offending signals. That's number one. You know, I turn the PL on it. The band opening that kept leaving it open. That's gone now. And actually, what brought this whole thing up is that I had measured the circulators on the system on ours and two of the offending intermite transmitters, and a little tweaking needed to be done. There was also some loose cable having poor ground, and there was a lot of RF in the room that shouldn't have been there. So we'll know tomorrow, but it may be a problem for being generated locally, not even by the antennas, but within the stage of the room itself.
All the extra RF you were sensing in the room. Kind of curious what kind of instrumentation we're using to see that, Eric Graham.
Well, each of the transmitters have the circulator connected, but let's put it this way. When the wires aren't tight and you wiggle them and you see these things pop up on a spectrum analyzer, you know that there's something bad going on here. Also, the harness on our duplex is getting a little cranky. It's 30 years old, so I'm going to have to do something about that, too, in the near future.
Eric, earlier tonight, I heard the very distinctive sound of knuckles being knocked on various objects at the repeater site, and it was coming through the repeater output. Only a person with earphones on would hear it, but I recognize that sound. I presume that was some of your troubleshooting procedure. Is that true?
Yeah, looking for microphony, and there's plenty of it. But, you know, it's actually the phase rock loops is doing it.
Yeah, Eric just pronounced that microphony. He's really calling it, what he was really describing as microphonic effects. If this was the best of all worlds, you put a transmitter on a shake table and you shake it, there should be no residual signals coming out of the transmitter because you're shaking it. Well, when it comes to the voltage-controlled oscillator of a phase lock loop, that may be a little bit too severe a requirement if you're not putting that voltage-controlled oscillator in some kind of a shock assembly, a shock-absorbing assembly. You know, putting it under 15 feather pillows, if you know what I mean, above 15 feather pillows. So there is a beautiful device made by the Frequency Sources Company, Martin Blocks Company, where they were taking a very high precision oscillator, putting it on a shake table, and you see all kinds of harmonics coming out of this high precision, very low spectral purity. Very high spectral purity oscillator. Then they turned on their magic device, which they have a patent on, with some kind of a feedback network right at the crystal resonator itself. And all of a sudden, all those undesired products on the spectrum analyzer screen went down by 20 or 30 dB. So there are techniques, but they're not easy. Anything further you want to add to all this before I go over to Howie? Over to you, Eric. K2EJ, K2RIW.
Nah, I should have been sending you CW. It would have been fun. Actually, the way the unit is designed and the way the stuff is mounted, you know, it's not intended to be put in anything moving. So, I wish I didn't hear it, but it's there, and, you know, it's mounted in a rack. Thank goodness there's no fans vibrating everywhere, so we don't hear the fans, but on some of the repeaters, you hear the fans because, you know, it shakes.
All right. It sounds like not enough mechanical isolation is taking place. Howie, I know you wanted to make a brief comment. Go ahead.
Just comment here, Dick, and I just want to amplify one thing. Even if you're on a single site with no other repeaters except your repeater, it's a good idea to use a circulator because if you're on a high building, you could be bothering another service 20 miles away. And at both sites, which have that kind of agreement, I think Jay will tell you that Eric will tell you that every 6 months, they will ask you to open your cabinet up. or some sites, they make you mount the circulator right outside your cabinet so they can take a visual inspection to see if you have that circulator. At other sites, they take that very seriously because they have a lot of the customers. But seriously, if anybody, if any ham or any group has a repeater on the air, even if they're the only people there, it's a good idea to have a circulator just for the simple reason is you don't want to cause problems with other hams or with commercial services. Because even a little one or two from a 20-story building or a 15-story or whatever could radiate miles away. Go ahead, Dick.
Okay. I think it's safe to say if you've done a good design or a good implementation of your repeater, no matter where you mount it, it will have circulator, to have a good circulator properly designed for that particular power level of your transmitter, mounted at your transmitter itself. Oh, there was another person who wanted to make a comment. Who was that?
KC2QIQ.
Go ahead, Glenn.
I was just wondering, Dick, if you could just save a space for me at the very end of the TechNet just to talk a little bit about, you know, circular polarization, circulators, and RCP, LCP, and magnetic fields and things.
Okay. Now, John, I think KC2WGB wanted a question, but we better go over to Paul because we're keeping up pretty late. Want to give us a slightly brief version of what's going on in space, if you're able to hear us, Paul. Hope the band opening has essentially disappeared. WS2N, K2RIW.
Do I have it?
Yes, you do, Paul.
Okay, very good, Dick. Oh, yeah. I just wanted to make really one comment. We do have two shuttle missions left. That's, like I said, a short, very short space report. And this one coming up is in November 1st. And then that's followed by another one in February 26th. You have Discovery coming up and then Endeavor after that. And this is the last Discovery flight. Of course, Endeavor will be the final flight of the shuttle mission. Originally, they wanted to shut it down in 2010, but they wanted to complete whatever they wanted to complete, so it's going into February. And I don't see any possible extension, so I think that's going to be pretty much it for the manned space flights for many years to come, unless private corporations get involved and drop it. So I'm willing to follow the robotic missions around, no problem. We could do that. And whatever manned flights go up to the International Space Station via the Russians. So far, that's the only way to do it. I mean, there are three different types of resupply ships going up to the space station. We still have the Russians with the Progress ships. You have the European Space Agency with the ATV. That's called the automatic transfer vehicles. They've been put up, a couple of them so far. We've had one by Japan that's been put up so far, H-2B, I think they call it, which carries twice the amount of cargo than the Progress Russian supply ship does. The ATVs, I believe, are about three times the mass that they can carry. So, but at least Japan, let me drop it. Japan has a nice setup. It doesn't even have to come in and automatically dock with the space station like the Russians do it with the European Space Station. They have a system where they get close to the space station, I mean real close, and then they reach out with the Canadarm2 from the space station and grab a hold of that and dock it to one of the nodes, the Harmony node. And you can go inside of it, you know, it becomes another room for a while. Half a year that it's up there and has all kinds of racks and things like that. And, so That'll be going up probably about two times a year. The next one's scheduled for, I believe, January of next year. Back to you, Dick. WS Twix.
I think there's something like six astronauts and cosmonauts on the International Space Station right now. And so there's a total of two shuttle launches going to take place with the rest of the history of the United States. November 17, I think you said, and November 1 and February 20. Will they be bringing up and bringing down any astronauts or cosmonauts? Do you think they're going to stay at the level of six? In which case, there's got to be a minimum of two Soyuz crafts there ready to act as lifeboats when need be. And also with six people on board, the rate at which consumables are being used is significant. Therefore, the progress ships have to come up more frequently. So will it stay at the level of six, to your knowledge? Paul, go ahead.
Yeah, it's going to stay at six. The space station was initially designed for eight. They worked their way up to, they started with two, and then they went to three, and then after the Columbia tragedy, re-entering space, they went back down to two, got back up to three again after a couple of years, finally got up to six about a year or two ago, about a year and a half ago, I guess, and it will stay that way. And yes, they have to have as many seats. If there's six people up there, they have to have at least six seats ready to go back. They don't want to leave anybody behind. Kids is a problem. When they had eight designed for the space station, there would have been enough seats because we had plans of having, it looked like a little shuttle called the X-38 that was going to be attached to the space station permanently. It looked like a little space shuttle without windows. That would have been able to carry everybody back. But that project was scrapped. I mean, they ran with billions of dollars, and they dropped it from planes, and they had a parachute and little skis on there to land anywhere. It was great, but they canceled that and they dropped it. It's WSUN, and that's pretty much it. The progress ships probably three or four times a year. That's what they're doing now. They won't change that. They're not going to accelerate that. But we do have the ATVs, automatic transfer vehicles from the European Space Agency, which carries three times the load of the Progress. And you've got now the Japanese H-2Bs going up there, which is about twice the amount of load volume that the Progress ship could bring up. To give you an idea, Japanese one is about 27 feet long, and the golf meat is 4'8". Probably about 12, 13 feet in diameter. So, twice as much room and probably as much weight. So that's it, Dick. Can you imagine all this stuff going to Mars? All this stuff that you're going to need to bring up? About halfway through, a little less than halfway through packing for Mars that you recommended, Dick. And I think we're going to be at the robotic missions for as long as I live. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I think that's a fairly good book. It was, and maybe still is, on the bestseller list for the New York Times, Packing for Mars by Mary Roach, R-O-A-C-H. It's a 2010 book, I believe. Published by who? Norton and Company. And I'm double-checking that it's a 2010. Yes, it's a 2010 book. And wait till you get to the sections on what you and I jokingly might call outhouse humor, although it's not intended as humor. When it comes to disposing of waste product and properly collecting of human waste products in zero gravity, you wouldn't imagine how difficult that is to do it properly without all kinds of side effects. Putting human beings in weightlessness is nowhere easy as you think. My last two questions, Paul, are... Let me drop. And by the way, as I said, I do recommend that book. You'll enjoy it. Very well written. The space shuttles, each time they visit the International Space Shuttle, Space Station, whatever fuel they have left over, a significant portion of it, is used to boost the International Space Station into a slightly higher orbit because it is continuously experiencing drag and slowly coming back down. And you really don't want that. Once we no longer fly the Russian Nova Fly shuttles, do you think they've well planned who is going to be doing the boosting in the future? Question number one. And question number two, is the International Space Station construction essentially complete? And related to that, how long do you think they intend to use the International Space Station? Are there projected uses for the next 3 years, 10 years, 30 years, and all of that time? A continuous flow of progress ships to bring up the consumables? You can see where I'm going on this one. Tremendous amount of hardware. If you don't keep supporting it, if you don't keep boosting it, it disappears on you very catastrophically. And heaven help you if it, in an uncontrolled manner, comes back down over a habitable area. You can see where I'm worried a little bit here, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, that'll probably burn that up maybe a little at a time, maybe disconnect one module after the other. I hope they don't do what they did with Mir. I mean, they just took the whole thing and burnt it up in one shot. This is much, much bigger than Mir. We'll see what they. I don't know what the plans are for the end of the space station. Initially, it was brought online for 15 years. Last I read about a year or so ago that they're going to double that. That'll be around for at least another 15-20 years from now. The completion of it took so long with all the delays that, they've really only just started to occupy it now. So I guarantee you it'll be up there another at least 20 years before we have to think about how they're going to bring parts back. And as far as refueling, the space station has thrusters. It does get refueled. And it gets refueled by progress ships. It gets refueled now by the Japanese refueling HB2 when they go up there, they'll have fuel on board. So, yeah, you're going to have to keep doing that. Let me drop it. The shuttle, when it was attached, would always bring it up every time, 14 miles, that was a standard number. But with enough of these resupply ships going up, always some fuel on board to do that, they'll be able to do it. They're going to have to. What else you got with that? You had another question in there somewhere, Dick, but I don't remember what it was. Oh, okay. Is anybody else planning to go up yet? We have the SpaceX is one group. There's a couple of other ones that are planning to resupply the space station with, they're private companies that will actually launch from Florida and places like that. So we'll have to see what's going to happen. I think there are a long ways away from doing that, probably at least a couple of years before you have a private company resupplying the, and eventually they'd like to bring astronauts aboard, on board. They're many years away from doing that. Back to you, Dennis.
Very fine, Paul. When it comes to the previous subject, magnetic fields, once again, this is the fourth time I've been there. There was a conference held in Chernobyl, New York, which is a couple hundred miles away from here, in the Catskill area, I guess the western Catskill area, where thousands of people from, I guess, about four countries and about 10 or 15 states of the United States come together for a 3 or 4 day conference to fly their electrically powered radio radio-controlled model aircraft. Sounds like a hobby.
Wow.
What these guys are doing with brushless DC motors and aircrafts is just out of sight, literally out of sight. We're talking about 10 and 20 horsepower, battery-powered electric motors being fired by fairly fancy computer circuits. And these aircraft, what can they do? Oh, I've seen aircraft move at 150 miles an hour, go straight up and go out of sight in like 5 seconds, thoroughly under control all the way. Any maneuver you can envision, helicopters flying upside down and whatever, electrically powered, high-powered aircraft. So when it comes to strong magnetic fields and proper control of them for these brushless DC motors, you ain't seen nothing yet. And as far as that technology has gotten, I see a path by which it's about to make some brand new breakthroughs in the next couple of years. The combination of batteries and the control electronics and the motors themselves. So I'm still recovering from that trip. I only came back a couple of hours. I came back a 3/4 of an hour before the TechNet began. Have we skipped over anybody? I think I was supposed to go to John, KC2WGB. I think you had a real question you wanted to be on the list among other people. Over to you, John, K2RIW in the TechNet.
WS, for one comment before I sign, Dick, for Wesley.
Yeah, go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, I don't know if he's still on, but there's a free paper that's given out at all the stores, when you go to these stores, and it's the Long Island Press. And it's not the, you know, Long Island Press from years ago, which was a regular newspaper, but it's a free paper that they give out. And it has headline story, and it's about four big pages all about Tesla and Shoreham and what they plan to do with it out here. And, you know, they had that whole thing set up there in 1901, and the future plans, and basically a biography also all about Tesla. I know Wesley's a big fan, so if you can get a hold of the free Long Island Press from a store, I don't know if they have that in Queens or not, but I know they have it out here. Very good reading for a newspaper. Back to you, Dick.
Paul, are you saying this is the most recent issue? How would he recognize the right issue? And once again, how many pages in there are about Tesla?
Four big pages. It takes a while to read it, to give you an idea. So, yeah, you recognize it. I think it's the 22nd, September 22nd issue. I'll have to look at the date on how they do that. It's in the stores now. The whole front page is a picture of, I think, Tesla's hands and all these big sparks. And the whole front page is of the paper. Recognizable to some people.
Okay, I know some people who collect that newspaper, so I'll try to check on those just in case Wesley has trouble finding it.
Get the issue.
Say that again, Paul.
Stand by. Let me get the issue, then, if you're going to do it that way. Let me find the exact issue.
But it's the most recent one. Most likely is the September issue.
USL.
Okay, why you're...
Online also.
Say again?
Is that accessible online?
Accessible online. I don't know what that means.
On the computer.
On the computer. I don't know what you're saying.
He wants to know if it's accessible online, Dick.
Ah, I see. Okay. Paul, maybe we'll have that information. I'm a little bit skeptical. I think it's a broadsheet. I don't think they go through all the effort of putting all of that material also online, as well as composing it for the broadsheet itself. But that's a guess on my part. I'll also check on that. It's a good question. John, KC2WGB, I think you had a question. Go ahead. Or you wanted to give us an explanation of previous material. You got it, John.
Thank you, Dick. Actually, I have two questions. One is directly in your field of expertise, and I have a question from Mel, if I might, too. Both of them should be quick, so I know it's getting late.
Fire away.
Okay, I wanted to touch base with you too on your opinion and what you thought. I spoke to Andy today about this. I'm looking to buy a diamond antenna at 1.2 gig. I'm going to have approximately 80 feet of feed line for it. Should I go with LMR 400, 600, or should I go to hardline? What do you think I'm going to need to get the best results? Money notwithstanding, just what do you think? And it's just a simple vertical, it's not a beam.
There's no hard answer on that. You could foolishly connect that antenna with a long length of RG58 cable. You'd have a tremendous amount of loss, but you'd be on the air. And yes, you wouldn't be happy. You could also connect it with, I think you might squeeze by frequency-wise with 1.58 air-filled Andrew Heliacs. I think that might not multimode, but I'll double-check on that. And of course, you couldn't afford the weight and the dollars. So, to any of those cables you're choosing, the data sheet is going to tell you the number of dB of insertion loss, and the number of pounds of weight, and the number of dollars that's going to be required to do it. There's no exact answer. It sure would be nice if you could keep the insertion loss to the antenna, let me pick a number, under 2 dB. But if it fell at 4.5 dB, it's not going to catch on fire and it's not a showstopper. On top of that, it could be a step-by-step function. If you can easily afford LMR 400 now, and then 2 years later when you upgrade the system, after you've already improved the low noise preamp and the transmitter and everything else, and now the weakest link in the chain is the feed line, and you upgrade to LMR 600, that's doable. And you might run into a great deal on eBay or whatever for available used cable. So I don't think there's an exact answer on what's the best insertion loss, just because 1296 is a much higher frequency. We amateurs don't get a nosebleed when we go up too high in frequency, if you know what I mean, John. I know I haven't given you an answer. I've given you a little bit of a philosophy. Over to you, John.
Hey, if you can afford it, go to over 5.
Okay, Eric was saying something. Say it again, Eric.
If you can afford it, you should use AVA 5. The losses are very low. I thought I heard him say 600 feet, which is like a 1296. You're asking for trouble.
Yeah, John, did you really... Well, first of all, the AVA 5, how expensive is that, Eric?
It's about $3.50 a foot.
Fine with the information.
And, John, how many feet are you going to run between the antenna and the rest of the system?
80 feet, Dick. It's just going to be 80 feet.
What's your gut feel on that one, Eric?
That's affordable. The only real expense beyond the cable and the connectors are like $125 each.
And WS2N?
Go ahead, Paul.
Okay, I want to get out of here. So here we go. September 16th. Through September 22nd edition, 2010, and then to be more specific, volume 8, issue 37, big picture of Tesla's hand, and the name Tesla scrolled right across the middle of the page, you can't miss it, and somebody asked about if they're online. I don't know if you can read the same thing online, but it's, they do have a www.longislandpress.com. I'm not sure what you're going to get when you bring that up, but I guess you could give that a try, too. Back to you, Dick. WS20.
Very good information, Paul, and thank you. Was there someone else who had a comment on any of the above before we go to John's second question?
K2KEY.
Yeah, he's going to be directing a question to you. So let me turn it over to John. He's going to give you the question. And you can give the double answer, Mel. Go ahead, John.
Thank you, Dick. KC2WGP. Good evening, Mel. I have a question. In my memory, I think I remember you speaking about using a spectrum analyzer that was software-driven, a small one, sort of inexpensive. Is my memory correct? It was you that was discussing that before I go on.
My friend bought one, well, spectrum analyzer actually. It's a network vector analyzer that's put out now that this works phenomenal. Gee, I can't believe how well that works. I basically was using it. Well, he too was using it basically for filter evaluation. It can be used, of course, as a spectrum analyzer, but it's actually a network vector analyzer, NVA system. And what the heck is the name? It's a blue-black box. It's sort of the fact that I think in the QST or someplace it's advertised. I can't think of the name of the company right offhand, but it's all I can say is it's kudos. What this thing does, I think you'd have to go a ton of money to purchase something like that that would give you that kind of response. Over.
It sounds to me like you will eventually come up with that name, and then you can pass it to John at that time. Any comments on that one, Mel?
What's the frequency range?
That was going to be my next question.
Now, they got two of them on the market. The one he has goes through about 180 megs. That's the cheaper version. They have one more expensive. There is one now that has really been really touted as a very cheap version, but works also, from what the reviews have been, extremely well. I don't know how much, you know, what you're really planning on doing with it. If it's amateur radio piece of equipment that you're looking to do amateur radio work with, this Ray Solutions I would look into. I haven't seen it yet, but I've heard good words about it. A company called Array, A-R-R-A, Array Solutions, over.
Signal Hound, it's good to like 4.5 gigahertz. It's like $800.
There you go, Eric. I was asking the question on the behest of Eric, so you can communicate with him the information. You too, Glenn.
How much money are we talking about?
$800.
Unit.
No, how much money are we talking about? No. I mean, I know that Tentec came out with the VNA that was in QEX. And that sold for about $600. I don't know if they're still producing it because I don't think they sold too many of them.
Now, there's a couple of them. There's a few of them on market now. The one at $800 is the one that really is the supposedly the top of the line right now. But if you don't have to go to 800, if you can work with up to 180 megahertz, you can get one for, I think it's Marion Rouse, $400, over.
Yeah, that's cool. Is it actually, or do I have to receive it, or do you have to reverse it?
Did you ask me how many ports?
Yeah, how many ports?
Ports.
Oh, cool. So I have to receive it, because the QEX one, you wanted to go, if you wanted to go, you know, look at it reflected or forward, you have to reverse the cable.
Well, this is based on, as far as it is, it's based on its X-11 system, over.
Oh, cool. Now I got to go look at it. Of course, for years I've been trying to get something for myself, and that sounds like it might be the answer. But I really need to go up to, you know, I'd like to go to a gig, but, 500 megahertz is fine.
Eric?
Yeah,
the Signal Hound is basically 1 hertz to 4.4 gigahertz. Its dynamic range is 140 dB, minus 140 to plus 15. It's got two ports to it. It does AM, FM measurements to it. It runs off a USB port right on your computer. You basically load it in software, and you're ready to rock and roll. I mean, for $800, it's one heck of a tool, and it's smaller than a pack of cigarettes.
What's the name?
It's the Signal Hound. As a matter of fact, if you want to write down the part number, Signal Hound USB-SA44.
All right, I'm almost around the corner from home. Signal Hound, I'll look that up as soon as I get in.
I mean, it's really a spectrum analyzer. It's optimized as a spectrum analyzer, but it's really a software-defined radio if you really want to come down to it with two ports. Back over to you, Eric. KC2QIQ.
Greg, Glenn, do you own one of these?
I liked it so much, Dick, I bought another. Actually, I've got two of them. The one I kind of keep in my, along with my laptop at a moment's notice, and another one that I kind of keep at work.
By the way, is it open for us?
I don't think so. I mean, it's open source to the point that it allows you to modify a lot of the parameters, but the software itself is, I don't think, I mean, it's compiled software.
It's got some open architecture.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that you said that it's, you know, it's essentially an SDR would mean that you could write stuff for it.
Yes, you can, Eric, as long as it's within the compiled program that's already there. Yes, I mean, there's a lot of hooks and handles where you can use it for many, many different things and basically control it all from your laptop. But when you said open source, a lot of times that means, you know, you can, you know, change the program and recompile it. No, it's actually within the program itself.
Oh, that's even cool. I gotta look this up. Maybe I'll be writing a check soon.
A kilobuck fish is phenomenal. You look at it, you'll fall in love with it.
Thanks, guys.
K2L. Go ahead, Bernie. The website is signalhound.com, just for anybody that wants to look it up. Just plain signalhound.com.
Well, you had another comment also.
Go ahead, Mel.
Just made it final that, Eric, these new little gadgets will rival the kilobuck units made, you know, commercially. And I used this one my friend had as determine certain parameters. Actually reworked the filter again to confirm, as Dick will tell you, considerable work I did on a filter, on a Chebyshev filter. And it was, I'm telling you, my mouth fell open, Eric. So it's got the kilobuck features for under $1,000, you're never going to beat it, over. And it does have, to some extent, what they call open architecture, over.
Yeah, that's good. That's just what I need. All right, guys. Now I got to take all this junk out of the car. And, you know, walk around the repeater, you can't just go up there with nothing. All right, you guys carry on. KE2J.
Okay. Have we skipped over anyone who signed in who had a question or a comment so far before we go back to any previous subjects? Give me your call letters right now. Okay, that's a good sign. As I said, I just came back from the NEAT fair. NEAT stands for Northeast Aero Technology. And these guys are in their 11th yearly conference of displaying to each other what is the state-of-the-art of electric-powered aircraft. And boy, there are electric motors in there that are just out of sight. Electric motor controls, all kinds of horsepower and capability, versatility. And so these aircraft, the highest power aircraft powered with a gasoline engine that you can think of in the past, model airplane, radio-controlled, these guys are way beyond that. I mean, they're way exceeding in horsepower hours and life of batteries. I mean, the modern-day batteries and the efficiencies of the circuits is just really something to behold. I've got a secondary interest in an aircraft, as you can tell, and you meet some very good people there. And some of them can tolerate my physics puzzles as to how does a wing develop lift. But that's another whole story. So that's where I've been for the last 3 days. When it comes to magnets, there's a lot to be learned. They're not easy. When it comes to magnetic circuits, transformers and chokes in particular, and now we're talking about other magnetic things like circulators and unique filters. Properly done, high technology, good performance, and the majority of electronic engineers have extremely poor understanding. And for a long time, I was one of them, until I started building of transistorized circuits that I needed, transformers that I couldn't buy, so I had to design my own. I started finding out about it. Glenn's the guy who seems to have the most amount of magnetic knowledge among this group when it comes to things.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
When it comes to things like transformers and inductors and fancy things for switching regulators and inverters and voltage conditioners and so on. Apparently Glenn's been doing quite a bit of that with reference to properly feeding some of these super high efficient light emitting diodes. And it looks like our homes will be using light emitting diodes. And when you watch these guys fly at midnight, so to speak, with tremendous arrays of light-emitting diodes on the wings and fuselage and vertical stabilizer and horizontal stabilizers of these aircraft, flying into pitch blackness of night and taking up a tremendous amount of airspace with multiple aircraft. These guys were doing combat at night with about 20 or 25 aircraft airborne simultaneously, either aiming for each other's tails or aiming for released helium balloons with lights inside and so on, to watch electrically controlled, electrically powered radio control airplanes flying at nighttime and doing all these fancy maneuvers. You realize that technology has come a long way. And so, anyone with any further questions or comments on all of the above, give me a call at K2RIW.
WGB.
Go ahead, John.
Quick question on magnets. I was rehearsing these questions with Glenn and some other people today. If we had two magnets, one suspended above the other, in the attraction mode, the magnetic field, is it circulating or is it static? I'd like to hear your opinion on that.
I'm going to make a guess that the reason you're asking the question is to try to find out, is continuous energy being dissipated, absorbed, used, or whatever? And is the magnetic field, the actual field lines themselves, although we draw them in circles as to representing their positions in three-dimensional space, are they really moving? My gut feel is they are not. By the same token, you and I are held down to this word by gravity. And in order to give it a name, we call the thing that does it gravitons. Well, we give it a name. I may not understand the disease I've got, and I call it a virus. Just because I give it a name doesn't mean I understand it. And gravitons, even though they got a name, I don't think we understand what gravity is. When you allow a magnetic field or a gravity field to be that generates the force, and you allow it by whatever means to generate that force through a distance, then you could say that work has been accomplished, whether or not it is a potential energy that's been built up or kinetic energy that's been built up. We can discuss those details. But during the time, two magnets are attracting each other, but they're stationary. You're holding them and not allowing them to move. And they hold each other for 10 minutes or 10 days or 10 years. Have they done continuous work for that time? I think the answer is no. I am guessing that may be part of what is the thrust of your question. Over to you, John, K2RIW.
KC2WGB. I tend to agree with you, Dick, because what I did as an experiment, I set those magnets up exactly like that, and I took an active CRT and brought the neck where the electron gun is near the magnetic field, and I let it sit there. And I saw no undulation at all in the waveform, so I don't think they're moving. Whether that proves it or not, I don't know. That's why I asked the question.
Yeah, when it comes to using electrostatic repulsion or electrostatic attraction, you've got a mechanism that will generate a attractive or repulsive force. And depending on the two objects that are in question, if you're using two objects, whether you're pushing them together against a repulsive force or pulling them apart against an attractive force, you're doing work on the system. And somewhere potential energy or kinetic energy is being, let's say, exchanged, stored, increased, decreased, whatever, exchanged. I'll just put it in general terms. So with electrostatic field, I can exchange energy if I allow that force to operate through a distance. Same thing with gravity, same thing with magnetic field. I read an article some time ago, I think I may have told you guys about it, as to where does the energy come from in nuclear fission. And believe it or not, the main source of energy of nuclear fission is electrostatic repulsion. In the particular article I was reading, let me drop. The question was asked, if I'm trying to construct, I think it was an oxygen molecule, and the oxygen molecule has a nucleus consisting of 8 protons and 8 neutrons, and also 8 electrons going around it, but to take the 8 individual protons and push them together in order to make that nucleus. Because they're electrostatically identical and repulsing each other, you have to apply a force. Until you get them close enough to where the strong nuclear force takes over and holds that nucleus together, until you get them close enough together, you're fighting that force of repulsion. You and I know that an oxygen molecule, a single oxygen molecule, is an extremely sub-microscopic object. The best microscope in the world is not going to give you a view of that element, of that atom. But assume we could. So I pick up these 8 individual protons and start pushing them together because I want to physically construct an oxygen molecule. Near the end of that pushing together operation, I am applying a force of, I think the number was 10,000 newtons. A couple of tons of force are required on each individual submicroscopic proton to push them together. Obviously, a tremendous amount of work is being done for you to simply take 8 protons and push them together to start the process of building a oxygen atom. If I could now use that oxygen atom in a nuclear reaction so that one of those protons comes flying out of there, at the instant that proton comes flying out of there, it is experiencing a force of multiple tons on one single proton. And you and I know that proton is very light. That much force on something light is going to...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
It's going to move it at some ridiculously high relativistic velocity. And when that particle comes flying out of there, and you and I would call it nuclear decay, it's going to hit something like a carbon rod or whatever that's going to absorb that energy. But where does the energy really come from? Electrostatic repulsion. Who would ever believe that something as complicated as nuclear energy, nuclear reaction, nuclear fission, is really primarily electrostatic repulsion? So whether I'm using electrostatic repulsion or attraction, magnetic repulsion or retraction, there's a degree of similarity here. And how you operate with them and how you understand how it all works and where the energy is flowing from to makes you run into some extremely interesting questions. We ain't got all the answers, but I think we're starting to ask the right questions. Over to you, John, K2RIW.
Great explanation, Dick. I love it. Yeah, and I assume that's why the first atomic weapon we built, they used an actual, almost like a cannon, to drive these two items together. The amount of power that's needed to force any atomic reaction is just incredible. So I see where you're coming from, and I do agree. But I thought that little experiment I did with the CRT, I would see some motion if, you know, the magnet is perfectly still. If I did see undulation in the wave, I would assume it was coming from the magnetic field moving, but it didn't prove out. So I agree with you. I don't think it's moving at all.
I think you've got about 2 or 3 ways of creating evidence for your hypothesis. Number one, the CRT. Number two, in many reactions where work is being done, quite often there's a heat exchange. I can have two magnets suspended vertically in the attractive mode or the repulsive mode, almost doesn't matter, and for very long periods of time, I don't think you could measure any temperature difference. That suggests that work is not being done. But it's not the be-all, end-all. But as you've heard me say in previous weeks, I see a strong relationship between the magnetic repulsion when I push things together, which stores potential energy when I've got them together, and if I let them fly apart, that I believe almost the identical amount of potential energy comes back to me as kinetic energy. It has, in my mind, strong similarity to compressing a spring. A compressed spring, if it's a quality spring and not degrading, stores potential energy, and when I let it spring back, I can recover the energy darn close to all of the energy I put into it. I think it's true of both a magnetic field. I think it's true of a spring. I know it's true of gravity. And I believe it's true of electrostatic repulsion or attraction. So each of these repulsive and attractive forces acts somewhat like the energy exchange of compressing a spring. I know there's some differences, but I think there's some similarities. So in the length of time that it's suspending or repulling, but no motion takes place, you could pessimistically say nothing is happening. Not everybody's going to agree with that. I understand that. But if you think something is happening, then we've got to propose an experiment.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
If we think something is happening, then we have to propose an experiment by which we can confirm our hypothesis as to what we think is happening. You've been doing some experiments now with levers and springs, and for a while you were using a solenoid to generate the force to measure what the two steady-state magnets are doing. And I think I recommended last week that that's not the best way to do it, because a plunger being sucked into a solenoid as you apply current to it is an extremely nonlinear process, a nonlinear in analysis. What it's doing internally is very linear. But the way you analyze it, the fact that the force versus distance doesn't follow a straight line relationship, and the current versus force versus distance doesn't follow a straight line relationship, to try to integrate the total energy under the curve, if you know what I mean, is difficult. A spring scale, I think, can do a better job. Over to you, John, KC2WGB, K2RW and TechNet. We're approaching the midnight hour.
Yes, Dick, I'll make my next comment quickly. I have not had the time to change over to the spring scale, but there's one other piece of evidence I found that near the CRT, when I compress the magnets, the field changes, and I saw a displacement on the CRT.
Thank you for visiting the Long Island Local Amateur Radio Club repeater
system. And what I think, when you said compressing the spring, I think we're actually storing the energy in the field, not in the magnet. Am I correct in that assumption?
Yeah, we got to worry about that. And that's a tough one. The fact that you push them together and the previous magnetic field changes in shape, that to me is perfectly acceptable. And you could confirm that by what you see on your CRT deflection. You could also use iron filings and plot the new magnetic field, iron filings and paper and so on. And there's other kinds of magnetic sensors. They make a card that allows you to sense magnetic fields. They make a card that you could hold over, what was it now, magnetic tape? I'm trying to remember what it was. But there's various ways of visualizing magnetic fields.
It's your sketch.
Say again?
It's your sketch.
I don't know if an etch-a-sketch would do it.
It's green paper. It's sort of like carbon paper.
Okay. But if you Google the word magnetic field and visualizing, they sell various materials that will allow you, in something that looks like a liquid crystal display, will allow you to plot the magnetic field. And so plotting the magnetic field before and after you push them together, I think the new magnetic field is predictable, the way it deflects. And where is the energy stored? Is it in the inside the magnet itself? I think the answer is both. As you push two magnets together, if you have tiny little microscopic holes.